Hey everybody, Dwan Bent Twyford. It's a Dwantastic day. I'm so excited to be at week three. Gosh, we've already had two super great weeks, and this is week three. So, quick recap. Everyone knocked on 10 doors, right? Right? Come on, tell me you did. Skype me and tell me you knocked on 10 doors. And everyone's got 25 signs out. And if you just got them, you put them out last week. So you've got 25 signs and 10 door knocks under your belt. So you are ready. You are ready, ready, ready to go into making the first offer with the bank. Now, last week, I spent a lot of time explaining the bank, the conversation, the homeowner, and how you're kind of the nucleus of everything. And it really does all end up kind of revolving around you. You're the person that is putting this deal together and structuring this deal from the beginning to the end. And then at the end, because of the good work and the hard work and everything that you did, you will get paid for your efforts a nice big whopping paycheck. The homeowners will get to move and start over and try and put this big mess behind them. The bank rep will think like, man, that was a great, Dwan was great. I can't wait to work with her again. And it's all going to be perfect. So in this week, I do need you to find two of your team players. Now in your program, I tell you all the team players that you need and how to get them. There's scripts for rehabbers, and it's all in there. So you don't need me to tell you what's in there, but I do need you right now to find your investor-friendly real estate agent and your title company. Your investor-friendly real estate agent and your title company. Those are the two people that you really need the most right now. Okay, so your investor-friendly real estate agent, that would be somebody that you would find probably at a RIA meeting. And, of course, you ask them, do you work with real estate investors? And now, let me tell you something. I'm really adamant about this. I do not want you to work with your cousin who got a real estate license or your brother, unless you're in business with them. Actual business partners. Don't work with a friend's agent, your friend's brother or sister, because here's what happens all the time. You gotta remember, I usually go once a month and teach somewhere around the country and teach a workshop. So I talk to thousands of people every year. Thousands of people every year. And I cannot tell you, oh my gosh, I need to make a list of all the things I never want to hear come out of anyone's mouth ever again. So many people come up and say, oh, I know my friend's cousin was an agent. So they said they'd help me on this deal. And I worked on this deal with them. And then it didn't work out. They didn't do what I wanted. And my deal fell apart. And now it's all weird. And I don't want to work with them anymore. But my friend says, they need the money and just all these dumb excuses. I don't even want to hear it. You find somebody that you don't know that is an investor-friendly real estate agent that wants to work with you, okay? You do not need to be working with anybody that's related to anyone that knows anyone about anything of anything, because this is a professional business. You are trying to build yourself an actual business. And you cannot build a business working with people that are free or cheap or friends of friends who say they'll do this or that thing. So I don't care who it is, if it's your parents, your own siblings, your kids. Oh, yeah, let me help you with that. No. Find people that you want to work with that are also professionals that you do not have a personal relationship with. Because I'm going to tell you something. Money will split people up, even family members. People get so weird over money. And deals will fall apart. And then you think like, oh, I asked this person that's your friend to put in a short sale for me and they couldn't get it done. They made me lose my deal. I mean, it's crazy how people just blame everybody and just don't do it. Okay? Find an individual that is independent of your personal life and your circle of people that you know. And not even like your friend's teacher, your kid's teacher who does real estate on the weekends. Like, nobody. Find a completely different independent person and let that person become your real estate agent. You need an investor-friendly real estate agent who needs to earn a living for themselves. They need to help you earn a living. And they need to make sure everything gets done right. And it's not going to happen if you're with, you know, somebody that's not a professional, that's more an arm's length person, okay? So seriously, and I know some of you right now, I've got one student right now, and she started working with somebody, and I was like, don't do it, don't do it. I told her, and it's someone I actually know, so I said, listen, I'm telling you, don't do that. Now, always, how do I get out of working with this person? I'm like, don't be looking at me for answers. I told you not to in this first place. Don't do it. You only want to work with someone that's like an arm's length kind of a person where you only see them when you guys are working together and doing deals together. They're not part of your social circle. Okay, I'm telling you, it causes weirdness. So when I give all these little tidbits like that, that's, again, stuff that's not written in the program. Because when you read it, people just glaze over it. But when you hear me talking about it, you're listening because you have to listen to get to the next part of the call. So I have you what I would call like you're like a trapped audience. So you have to listen to this stuff to get to the next stuff. But I'm just telling you from the beginning because just yeah, I'm assuming that most of you are starting out and you're brand new and you're really trying to build a good business for yourself. And I'm telling you for sure, you're going to create a bunch of weirdness if you just don't work with other people. Don't work with your family. I mean, now, I was partners with my dad for a while. He would fund a few, way back in the beginning, my dad funded a couple of my deals, and we split the profits after everything. And I did a couple of deals with my sister, but she came and worked at the houses, and we fixed them up, and we flipped them, and we split the money. So I did a couple of things like that, but never did I go into business with any of them because I knew that eventually money would make it weird, and it always does, so don't do it. Now, you also need a title company. So you're going to need a title company that wants to work with an investor-friendly title company. So, again, you can find those at your local RIA. If you live in an area that doesn't have a RIA within 1 hour of where you live, then I don't know, maybe take a trip, you know, find out like where the main RIA is, and there might be a RIA, you know, an hour and a half away. It's worth the trip over just to see and to meet people and grab as many business cards as you can and, you know, make some connections for yourself. So an investor-friendly title company, you would ask them simple questions like, you know, do you work with real estate investors specifically? Do you work with homeowners, like end users? You know, you're working with people like that that are trying to sell their house retail. Because a retail title company and an investor-friendly title company are two completely different title companies. And I have had this conversation with so many thousands of people. I think I'm going to make it one of my frequently asked questions over on my membership site where I can just say, go there and watch the video. But I've had people say, Dwan, I called 20 title companies and none of them said that they would work with an investor. They don't do LLCs. They don't do land trusts. They don't do double closings. They don't do 48-hour closings. They don't do transactional this and that. And I'm just like, okay. Well, I think what we're doing might be illegal. I heard from someone this was illegal. I'm like, what? doing a short sale, trying to assign or double close or use an LLC or use a land trust or trying to do a transaction with funding. I'm like, well, if it's legal, why is it a business? Why are there millions of people in the world doing it? Why are there companies dedicated typically working with real estate investors? One of us, why aren't we all in jail? So you got to understand, a title company is either going to work with investors or they're going to work with end users. An end user would be a homeowner that buys a house, moves in with their 2.5 kids and their dog and their husband and the wife with the white picket fence. Okay, that's an end user. Title company that we want specifically works with real estate investors. Specifically, they want to work with us. Okay, they're not looking for users, they're looking for people like us. They do creative financing, which is legal. They do just all kinds of creative things. That's what they do. That's what they like. That's the niche in the business that they chose out for themselves. So it's like if I tell people I'm in real estate, they're like, oh, are you an agent? And I say, no, I'm an investor. Oh, you're an investor. So same thing in real estate. There are millions and millions of real estate agents in the country. Millions of them around the world, millions of them. But there's just a handful of people that are investors. People like us, buying, flipping, selling, holding, doing the creative stuff. So we are a small niche. We are like real estate is like one industry out of millions of industries. And then we're a niche inside of that industry. So the title companies, again, most of them are all end users, just like real estate agents. Drive people around, show them all houses and do open houses. Those are the main real estate agents. And then you have the investors, the people like us, that carve out a niche inside of a niche. And then there are title companies that do the same thing. They carve out a niche inside of a niche. So an investor-friendly title company, they are rolling in the deals and the closings. They probably have so many more closings than a regular title company. Because in your whole town, like in Denver, there's maybe two title companies down there that service the whole entire area, like within 100 miles. There's just a couple title companies that really, truly work with investors, like 100% all investor friendly, 100% that's all they do. But there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of title companies. So you may end up trying to email or contact 75 title companies and they all say no, 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 no. And then you find the one that goes, oh yeah, we specifically work with investors. Now if you're online and you're Googling title companies in your area, you know, maybe within like a 50-mile radius, the ones that work with investors should state clear on their site what they're looking for is they're looking to work with investors. Okay, so it's very simple. You just got to find them. It's the same with real estate agents. I don't want to work with a real estate agent that works with homeowners, that shows houses and does open houses. I want to find an investor-friendly agent that works with investors. They know our business. They know how to present short sales to the bank for us when the bank demands that that happen. I want to work with people like that. So just like you guys want to work with me, you want to work with someone that specifically takes folks that are interested in becoming real estate investors and teaches them how to become successful real estate investors. So we all have our little niches, okay? And this is mine, and this is yours, and this is your title companies, and this is your real estate agents. So it's all about finding the person in your niche and not worrying about the people outside your niche. So I don't want a bunch of you Skyping me and saying, I can't find a title company. Well, go to a real estate, go to a REIA meeting, REIA, Real Estate Investor Association. I tell you, if you look at Meetup and type in your area and just look for any kind of real estate investing gathering, there's a million meetups. I mean, Meetup is like so overdone. There are a million meetups. So you can find something where you can go to something and you can find an agent and a title company. Should not be a hard thing to do, but just make sure, again, that they're not part of your circle. And yeah, you'll become friends with them. You may go to parties with them here and there, but just don't work with people that are like, you know, your best friend's cousin. So I'm telling you, it never pans out. So just don't do it. All right. So you've talked to your homeowner. They love you. You did your repeating, approving, and responding. And they just think you're like the best thing since sliced bread. And they signed a contract to sell the house to you. And you have an authorization to release information. And you've contacted the bank. And they're like, yeah, we'll do your deal. I just need you to send me a couple of things. So here's the part where I think people get a little confused sometimes, because not every bank asks for the same thing. Like one bank may say, I want a listing agreement. I want tax returns. I want a hardship letter. I want proof of hardship. I need 10 comps, comparable sales. I need pictures. I need this and this and this. And you're like, dang. And another bank is like, you know, we'll just take a contract and a listing agreement and a hardship. That's all I need. So in the program, I have like all the things that the banks might ask for. And so people always say, well, should I get my whole package together and be ready? And I said, no, just contact the bank. Let them know that you have a signed contract and you have a listing agreement. You have an authorization to release information. You have a signed contract. You have an authorization to release information. What do they need? You can get them anything they need in 24 hours. And this is kind of where, you know, like back old school, we would send in this giant package and send it in. And then they say, oh, yeah, you know, and if it's too much information, they would toss it. And they say, oh, yeah, I don't have your package. Send it again. So you could send the same package, no joke. You could send it, you could send it in 8 times. And they, but it's too much. And then someone went around trying to convince all of you that it needs to be like coil bound, which was the worst thing. I thought there's no loss mitigation rep, the face of this earth, that's going to stick that in a folder or undo that coil and scan all that information into a computer. It is not going to happen. So I will tell you one of the things I do. I still do this today. I've done it for 100 years, but I still do it today even. If a loss mitigation rep, even if it's like email me the pack. Oh, I can't find it. I didn't get it. Send it again. If they ask me to send it more than twice, then what I do is I get a box, a 3-foot by 3-foot box, and I put the papers, whatever it is, even if it's just 2 things, a listing agreement and a hardship letter. If they ask me to send it more than twice, I get a 3-foot by 3-foot box. I'm not even joking. And I put the 2 pieces of paper in the box and I FedEx it to them. Because they say, hey, listen, I'm just going to mail a copy. You know, what's your extension in your desk? And, you know, where are you? And, oh, okay. And they always give it out because it's not a big secret. So I FedEx a box to them. And now here's the thing. They live in that cubbyhole land. So those little cubicles, I don't even know how big they are. But what are they like? I don't even know. 6 feet by 6 feet or something? They're not very big. So they live in the cubbyhole world. And in those little cubicles, you just have a small space that's a desk because you've got your computer and your keyboard. And usually the fax goes to some general fax on the whole floor that everyone uses. So there's not a lot of space in there. So when you send them a big old box, they have to open it because they have to get it out of the cubicle because they can't work with it in there because it takes up all the desk space. And half the size of the little cubby that they're in the first place. So I cannot tell you how many people Oh my God, I'm so ornery sometimes. I cannot tell you how many people from the bank will call me up and be like, "Hey, Dwan, this is Barbara from the bank. You send me a 3 foot by 3 foot box and it has two pieces of paper in it. What is wrong with you?" And they're usually laughing. I say, "Well, you've asked me to send my package twice. I sent it. You said you didn't get it, so I want to make sure you have it. Do you have it now?" "Yes, I do." "Okay. So do you need to put it in a folder? Do you need to scan it in? What do you need to do to get that into the file so we can move on to the next step?" Now, this one girl, I tell you what, I used to torture the banks like really super bad, super, super, super bad. I remember this one girl, she made me so mad because I had sent her, I had FedExed her, I had emailed her, I had faxed her. So I literally went and got like a 5 foot box. I was so pissed off when I went to the store. I got a giant box and I dropped in like there was eight pieces of paper. And she goes, "What is wrong with you? You sent me a 5 foot box. This is eight pieces of paper." I opened that box. Everyone in the office came over to see what was in it. And I opened it and there's eight pieces of paper in the bottom of the box. And she was just like, "What is wrong? My boss came over. Everybody came over. What is wrong with you?" And she was so mad. And I started laughing. I said, "Well, do you have my package now?" "Yes, I have your package. It's in a 5 foot box. Who does that?" And I said, "Well, somebody like me that's looking to get this deal done and help these homeowners and get this deal off of your plate and move on to the next level. And you're not helping me and you keep making me resend. I mean, who can lose something that many times? You left me no choice but to put it in a box." And she's like, "But there's eight pieces of paper." And then I thought later, I thought, you know, I should have thought with those little peanut things, those little popcorn white things. Oh my God. She would have a mess on her hands then, especially if the paper was at the bottom. But I'm not that mean. I have a sense of humor, a little bit of a wicked sense of humor, but not like totally torturous. So I go to all kinds of crazy lengths to do stuff. And usually I just do it. I'm laughing so hard. I'm just like, "Oh my gosh, this is the best moment right here. I can't wait to get a phone call when this box gets to the other end. I can't wait. I'm so excited when they call. I'm all, they'll be like, "Hey, this is so and so. I'm calling from the bank." I'm like, so I act dumb. I'm like, "What call? Which house are you calling about? You know who this is. You sent me a box." I'm like, "No, I don't know. What are you doing? Which address? What are we talking about?" So I mess with them for a minute and then they're like, "Dwan, okay, I got the message. What do you want?" So I'm like, "Hey, I wanted the same thing I wanted the first time we talked. I just want to close the deal. I don't understand." So honestly, if you have to resort to tactics like that, I will tell you that you'll laugh your butt off. You'll have a super good time. The person that gets the box will be mad just for a minute, but then they'll laugh because they'll be like, "What kind of crazy does it take for you to do that?" I'm like, "Hey, it doesn't take crazy. It takes a person who's really wanting to get the deal done. I'm all about the homeowners, and you are not helping me. So when you decide to help my cause, I will leave you alone." So, and you may think that the bankrupt will get mad. And I always just say, "Hey, listen," because I've had a few of them say, "You are crazy. I'm never going to work with you." This is my standard comeback. "Hey, listen, tomorrow's a new day. I have nothing to do tomorrow. But put together boxes. In fact, I will send you a box every day for the next year if that's what it takes to close this deal. So you can work with me today, or you can get a new box tomorrow." And then there's a pause and there's a silence. And then there's always like that shoulder shrugging when they're like, "What? What do you want?" And then I laugh because it's like, "Ah, I won." So it never cost me any deals. I always just joke that I can keep on sending boxes. Like I can send boxes all day. Bring to this till the cows come home. I've got boxes and I've got time. And I don't have time and I have to go buy the boxes. But you know, they don't know that. But it is super funny to do it. So if you ever get a chance to to mess with them, just do it once for me. And then tell me what happened. Oh my gosh, I'm insane. All right, so now they for sure have your package. And you ask them what they want, and they told you. Now in the past, and it may even still say that in the program, that I send all these items in. But ever since the recession, the banks aren't asking for, they're asking for all of the things, but not as much paperwork. They're able to do deals now with less paperwork. And the main thing that the banks want now that they didn't always want, but the main thing I think, I don't know, I think 100% of the time at this point, you have to do it is a listing agreement. So this is, so a listing agreement means the bank wants to see the house listed. So this is where your investor-friendly real estate agent, that's not your buddy, your investor-friendly real estate agent comes in because they are going to do a listing agreement. So this is how a listing agreement works. Your agent will go with you over to the homeowner and they will fill out a listing agreement agreeing to list the property and putting the property into the MLS, okay, into the multiple listing service, the MLS. So the property is going to go into the MLS and they're going to print out a copy. The agent, the real estate agent, is going to print out a copy of the MLS listing. And then you're going to send that to the bank so the bank can see that you tried to list the property. Okay, so now everyone says, well, what do you list it for? Well, you have to list it for whatever they owe, which is usually too much, all the back payments, everything, and then you have to tack the real estate commission up on top of that. So typically, the house gets listed for more than the house is even remotely worth. Because they typically owe what the house is worth, and they have late payments. And the thing is, it's not that the late payments add to the mortgage. It's all the fees, the attorney fees and the forced insurance and the real estate taxes and all the stuff that the bank charges you. I mean, those fees can be $10,000 or $15,000. So now all of a sudden they have their balance of $200,000, and then they have, you know, $15,000 in fees, and then they have 12, 13,000 in real estate commission. So it's way more than the house is worth. So the bank does that because, again, thinking from the bank's point of view, the bank loans money so that you can buy a house. And then typically within 6 months of you buying your property, you'll get a letter in the mail that says, make your payments over here. These people are going to service or take care of the loan for us. So now you're paying a servicing company. Even though you borrowed the money from Wells Fargo, they sold the note. So the note on your house, so let's just say you personally buy a house for $200,000 and you have, you know, 3% interest and you have a 30-year loan. And then all of a sudden, you know, 3% interest or 4%, whatever, over 30 years is a lot of money. So what the bank does is the bank takes all these brand new houses that they just lent money on because they have the note on your house, and they put all those together and then they sell them off to a servicing, to somebody else, to another bank. Then they have a servicing company, and then they take care of the day-to-day details, getting your payment, posting it to your account, keeping you in good status, reporting it to the credit bureau, all those things like that. So when you are dealing with the bank or the servicing company, each of these houses is in a portfolio. So like using Wells Fargo, for example, every single loan that they've ever given out in the entire United States over the past 30 years, that loans that are not paid off, they're not all in one big giant bunch. They are in what is called portfolios. So one portfolio may have 10,000 loans in it. And they sell that loan to ABC Servicing. And then another portfolio could have 25,000 loans in it, and they sell that to XYZ. But the originating bank was still Wells Fargo. So now you get a thing, you get these homeowners that call you, they got a piece of paper, we're closing on your house, call this person, they'll work out your deal. Then you get another call from another homeowner, says, I bought my house in Wells Fargo, and here's who I'm making a payment to. Because this has happened to me on a whole bunch of occasions. So you have two houses, both of the loans originated from Wells Fargo, you're doing short sales with two different companies. Well, one company says, we will just take a listing agreement and a hardship letter. And the other company says, we want a listing agreement, we need the contract, we need a hardship letter, we want proof of the hardship, we want the last 3 years of tax returns, we want 12 months of bank statements, we want this and this and this. And you're like, dang, okay, both these loans were started with Wells Fargo. They're two different companies. I'm sending 15 items in over at one bank and two items in over at the other bank. Why is that? Well, because the banks are in different portfolios, so each portfolio has a criteria of what they need done to write off a loss. So they're going to take, so you get this bank that is owed $200,000 and they take $100,000, they have to write off a loss of $100,000. Okay, you follow me? So in order for them to write that loss off, because all these banks have insurance, in order for them to write that loss off, they may have to have 18 items because they have a checklist. So if their checklist, if the bank's checklist says listing agreement, tax returns, bank statements, whatever, and you leave off two of the things because you just can't get them. The homeowners can't find it. You can't round it up. If you leave two things off the checklist, then the bank will call you back and say, nope, sir, we can't do your deal. And you're like, I don't understand why they made. I sent them everything on that list just about. I couldn't find, get the tax returns. It's impossible. Well, the bank's not saying no to be mean. The bank's saying no because they cannot write the loss off unless their checklist is full. So when you leave off one item, and it could be they want to see pictures of the living room. If you leave off one item off what the bank's asking you for, they say no because you're not meeting their checklist and their guidelines of what they need. So when people say, I work with that bank, and they said no at the end, I guarantee you all the time, if you look back, it's always user error. I find out that whenever I have to update something on my computer or update something on my phone, I have to learn some new technology that I get super frustrated about because I can't figure it out in like 2 seconds, and I end up calling the hotline asking for help, it's always me. I miss a little drop-down box that I didn't see, or I missed this, or I missed that, and 100% of the time, it's me. It's not the program didn't work, it's not it got downloaded wrong, it's not anything, it's always me. And then I start laughing and say, oh, thank goodness for techies. I'm so happy to have people like you to help people like me, make my life so much easier. And then I laugh with them and say, so is that like the dumbest thing you've ever helped anybody with? And they'll be like, no, actually, there's people worse than you. We have people that call and say, my computer stopped working. And I just say, hit the power button. And they hit it. They go, oh. So then I'm like, okay, thank you for not letting me be the dumbest person that you've ever helped with this tech issue that I'm having. So it's just funny because it's always me. So I've come to realize it is me. So I take longer now and I read tutorials and I try to figure things out, but I only have an attention span that's so long. And if I can't figure out something new, like I just downloaded a program. I haven't even opened it yet. So I guess you'll hear me rant about this at some point. It's to make ebooks in 2 minutes. Now, am I going to be able to make an ebook in 2 minutes? Doubtful. I could probably make one in 10. But can I figure out the program without having to call for help? I don't know. I think so. I hope so. I feel like I'm pretty smart these days on the tech thing. I get all the stuff. I can even like make my own websites. I feel super cool because, you know, I'm up there. But there's so much stuff that's so much ahead of me. I can't even begin to wrap my mind around all the stuff that's out there. So I'm going to start putting out little ebooks. And will they be easy? And will they take me 10 minutes or 2 minutes? I don't know. They'll probably take me an hour, hour and a half. I'm sure on the first one, I'll scream my standard, I hate technology. And then when I figure it out, I'll be like, oh my gosh, this is the best thing I've ever used. This makes my life so easy. So the next time you see me speak, ask me how my ebooks are going. Actually, I'll be able to tell you by the end, because by the time we get to the sixth week, I will have already tried to make a couple. So I have to see if I'm pulling my hair out. But when I call for help, it is always me. So when you get your short sales turned down and you didn't fulfill the list and do all the things they ask, it's you, okay? Banks can't just write off money with no paperwork or some kind of something. They can't just say, oh, okay, yeah, we'll forgive half, 50%. That's good. Yeah, okay, bye-bye, thank you. Talk to you later. They just can't do it. It doesn't work like that. Okay, so you have to meet the bank's guidelines. And some banks, so several times, one time I had three deals. This is so weird that this happened. I had three houses, ironically, on the same street, all with the same bank. Each of the three houses, one would not do the short sale. The other two did, and they asked for such completely different things. And I thought, man, this is just the weirdest thing. And that was a long time ago. But that's when my bank reps were always super nice to me because I always sent them goodie bags and gift baskets. And I was really nice. And, oh, you're a rock star. Thank you for helping me. You're the best. But my bank reps have always been really good to me. And when I say, hey, listen, I don't understand. I have these three houses, and I actually had the same bankrupt. I got them all at one person's file, one person's desk. And I was like, I don't understand why there's three different outcomes. So this one bankrupt many years ago explained to me about portfolios and how they are and about the checklist and how they write things off and where the money comes from and, like, where's the bigger bank that owns that bank and kind of explained a little bit more. So I was thinking more on, like, it taught me to think more on, like, international banking instead of, like, well, okay, I'm here in Fort Lauderdale and I have three houses on the same street. I don't understand why I can't just get the same exact result for all three houses when I'm talking to the same person. And all the houses were in separate portfolios. So now some of the portfolios will not take a short sale at all. They say, no, we take all of our houses back and we offer them out as leases or we rehab them and sell them retail. So sometimes that'll be the answer. And so that's the answer for that portfolio, not for that bank. That's the thing that y'all have to understand. It's not for that bank. It's for that portfolio. Okay, they're just like, yeah, no, we don't do it that way. That house got to come back. Another bank will say, well, we can take 60%, you know, we can take 60% of the retail value. That's what our portfolio allows us to do. Some are like, yeah, we'll go 50%. Some are like, no, we have to stick at 75% of the appraisal. 75, that's what we do. That's what this portfolio does. So if you'll just start asking the bank more questions, the bank rep, the person you're talking to, ask them more questions. Like, what is it that your bank needs to say yes to my short sale? What does this bank need? What does this servicing company need? What does this portfolio need that this house is in, this portfolio this house is in? What do you need in order to accept my offer? So when you start talking to the banks like that, like, you know, what do you guys need? I understand all your houses are in different places all over the world, and you're the servicing company. Well, the servicing company can make a decision up to a certain dollar amount. So maybe the servicing agent can say, okay, it's a $200,000 house. Without having to call the boss, I can take 150. Well, 150 is really not good enough because how are we going to flip the contract and make any money if it's only worth 200? So we need to buy it for 100. So then to go below that, now they have to contact their superior. And then they have to find out what is the checklist? What does the bank need? What is the deal to make this deal work? And when you start asking better questions, you'll find out you'll start getting better deals. And those are the kind of questions that you ask. Hey, listen, I totally understand your industry. I know that you service houses from many, many different banks. You sell them off in portfolios. They're in groups. You know, how do we get this group to write the, what's their criteria for the write-off? What do they need so they can satisfy? Because most of these loans are all insured. Everything's insured. So the bigger bank has to meet this checklist to write the loss off on their books. So for them to write the loss off on their books, they have to have A, B, and C pieces of paper. And without those, they can't write the loss off. So they're not going to take the loss. They're going to say no. Okay, so you just have to be just a more educated investor in order to get all of your short sales done. And again, you have to look at yourself as if you were the big bank. If you were Wells Fargo, a worldwide bank, and you were going to take short sales, what would you want to write it off and get it off of your defaulting loan section of your paperwork over into this house is gone and I wrote off this amount of money and, you know, I get reimbursed this amount of money from the insurance and, you know, how does this, like, what would you want? So the bank is the same. They have certain needs and criteria, and you can't get around it. So I've had people say, I sent in a package with 100 pieces of paper. They said no. I'm like, well, did you ask them what their specific checklist was? No. Well, find out what their checklist. They might only need four things. Putting together a big package and coil binding, what the hell's that? Who needs that? Who's going to read all that? I would not. I had this one guy, the guy that was teaching that years ago. I said, hey, this is Dawn. You know, he knew who I was. I said, send me one of your packages. I'm really curious to look at what you're doing. I'm not going to copy. I just want to see. And I mean, by the fourth page, I was zoned out. I was like, oh my gosh, who on God's earth is going to read all this crap? Not me. So if I was the bank, I would just want a sales contract, a listing agreement, and a hardship letter, and I'd be good to go, and I'd write that puppy off and move on and lend more money out and just get going. So you have to, so the listing agreement, so let me back up to the listing agreement. So you get your real estate agent that's investor friendly. They list the property. Now you're thinking, but Juan, I'm buying the house. Well, of course you are. So hear me. They're going to list the property for the amount owed, plus all the fees that have been tacked on by the bank, plus at that point, you know, commission, the whole deal, the whole shebang. They're going to list the property. Then they are going to print out the listing and give it to the bank because it meets the bank's checklist. Then after the bank has it and says, yes, we're good, you remember that you have a signed sales contract with the homeowner. So the homeowners have an offer in writing and it's yours. So your agent goes back in to the listing, to the MLS, and they mark the property as pending because you have a contract that is pending because you want to buy the house and close on it. So the agent goes back, marks the property as pending, and then writes in the notes, no backup offers. Now, the reason the bank is asking for the listing agreement is the bank is just saying, I have to meet my checklist, check that I had the house listed, we made an attempt to sell it, nobody else made an offer except for Dawn. So we have to accept Dawn's offer because it was a Dawn-tastic offer. Okay, so that's all it is. the checklist and the listing agreement is so that the bank can print a copy out, put it into the folder and the file of that property, and show that the house was listed in the MLS. They never go back and say, okay, because, I mean, loss of negation could be in California and you're in Texas. They're not going to go, you know what, let me call the MLS all the way in Texas and make sure that this house is actually out there and listed and being shown. Who's going to do that with 1,000 files on their desk? It's ridiculous to even think that would ever happen. So after the listing agreement is printed, after the bank has a copy, and the bank is satisfied, yes, this is what I need exactly, then your agent goes back and marks it pending because you have a signed contract with you and the homeowner, so it is pending. So there's no lie there, there's no deceit, it is pending. And then it says no backup offers, and then that's what you want. The bank gets no calls, no offers. The agent doesn't turn in anybody else's information. It just sits there, and the bank goes, okay, well, it's been listed for 30 days, so now we'll take your offer. And you may have a 30-day listing agreement, a 60-day, or a 90-day. I hate when they do 90 days. If the requirement from the bank is a 90-day listing agreement, guess what? Nope, just guess. You have to actually wait 90 days. Because again, it's the checklist from the bank that they have to write the property off. So if they say, I must have a 90-day listing agreement, you can ask them, is there any way you could get a 30-day or a 60-day agreement approved by your boss? Because I really would like to close this house. They owe more than it's worth. You and I both know nobody else is going to look at it. Is there any way that I could get a shorter listing time approved? Could you ask someone at your bank? Could you go to your boss, who is an asset manager? Could you go to them and say, on this deal, can I get in writing that a 30-day listing agreement is going to be approved? And they'll probably say no. And so that deal, you have to wait 90 days. You have to go back to the homeowners and say, look, they're going to wait 90 days. They've agreed not to sell the house at the foreclosure sale because they know I have a contract with you. But the 90-day agreement is required by the bank to write off the loss. And there's nothing I can do to speed that up. So enjoy your house. Start packing. Start looking for a place to live, because in 90 days, you have to move. And then you have to wait. So that's why you can't have one deal at a time going on, because you have to wait 90 days on that one. So you need to always have, if you're just working as an individual, just you, no partner, no nothing, you need to have 20 deals in your pipeline on any given day. Just, and they don't have to be like deals that are solid, that you're heavy, hot and heavy working. Just 20 contracts should be on your desk on any given day that you're trying to see, is it a deal you want? Is it a good deal? Is it a short sale deal? Is it a high equity deal? Is it a no equity deal? Is it a rehab? Is this a straight flipping of a contract? But because you're going to toss half those away anyway and narrow down to the ones that you actually want to work on. But you have to have all these houses. You have to have a lot of deals going on, because if you get 5 deals that all want 90-day listing agreements, you better either have a job or some money saved up or some other deals getting ready to close, because you have to wait 90 days, 3 months. You have to just wait. So keep that in mind, okay? So now... The bank wanted the listing agreement. They wanted a hardship letter. There's a bunch of hardship letters in the program. Just pick one that sounds like your homeowners. Have them read over it. And if it sounds good, use that. Just take off the thing at the top of the page that says sample hardship letter and take off the page number. And I say that because, yes, that has happened so many times. People just print the page and send it in. It's like, really? It says sample hardship right at the top of the page, fool. All right, so get whatever the bank needs, get it all together, get it turned in, and then remember, you're negotiating. So we have a three-step process. We do the first offer, we do the second offer, and we do the third offer. And the reason we do each of the offers is because I understand before I contact the bank, I understand I'm going to go into a negotiating situation. So I understand that when I negotiate, I don't give them my best offer first and say, that's it, take it or leave it, because no one's going to get a deal like that. Okay, so when people go, I put in a package and they said no, and that was it. It's like, no, you can't do it like that, guys. Come on. You're negotiating. So you're going to start with a super low offer. And they're going to start with a high offer. And then you're going to raise yours, and they're going to lower theirs, and you're going to raise yours, and they're going to lower theirs, and you're going to meet somewhere in between. And that's what a negotiation is. A negotiation is a conversation between two people where neither one gets exactly what they want, but they're both happy with what they got. So if you put in a lowball offer and the bank gives it to you for some reason, but it's so low, they don't feel good about the offer. They don't want to work with you anymore, whatever. But if they give you an offer that's so high and you take it anyway, well, then you're not going to feel good about the deal because you're not making any money either. So that's what negotiating is. If people come to terms, I mean, we buy, like I said, my husband buys so much stuff on Craigslist. So we are both constantly negotiating with people, and they'll be like, yeah, I want this for, you know, $800. And then you go there and you're like, how about $600? And they're like, no, how about, you know, $750? How about we meet in the middle? So, okay. And you shake hands and you meet in the middle. They're happy. They got money and they got rid of the item. We're happy because we got a better deal and we got the item that we want. So everybody negotiates. If you've ever traveled out of country, especially like to Mexico, and you go in like all those straw markets, they haggle and you tell them, no, this is my bottom line. And you start to walk out. And if you put one foot outside that door, they're like, wait, come back. And they'll beat you down. You'll beat them down. You'll haggle back and forth. Then they'll give you what you want. Because in the bottom line, they're still making money and you're super happy because you got a deal. And the thing is, the deal you got, that's what they wanted for it anyway. But it's super fun to do. Haggling and negotiating is so much fun. So anyway, that's the deal. So you're going to go in with your low offer and the bank's going to give you a high one. And you come in with the second offer. And the second offer, you know, we're talking about the neighborhood and all the things going on. And, you know, on the third offer, we're talking about the money and the financial loss of the bank. And the first offer, we're talking about the homeowners a lot. And the homeowner's hardship and all the things that the homeowners are going through. And so the important thing to remember is the reason there's a three-step offer is because you're not going to get it on the first one. And if you do, if you make a super, this has only happened to me three times in like the whole 25 years. If you make a super low, what you think is a super low ball offer and the bank says yes, like just straight up, they go, okay. Immediately, your radar goes up and you're like, hang on a minute. Why did they say yes right away? What's wrong with this house? Why are they taking this low offer? What do they know that I don't know? Something's wrong with this deal. And the offer that you thought was really good 1 minute ago is now the worst offer in the world and you don't even want the house anymore. The first time it happened to me, I said, what do you mean yes? She says, well, we'll take that offer. And it was like a $100,000 house. I think I offered like $32,000 or something, really super low. And they said, okay. And I was like, excuse me? She says, yeah, we can take that. I'm approved to take that much. I said, well, but you didn't even counter me. She says, no, we can live with that. So I said, well, so my first thought was, well, how much less could I have offered and gotten the deal anyway? Like, am I overpaying by $5,000? Like, what's happening here? And I said, listen, is there something about that property that you know that I don't? She says, no, the boss said take anything. you know, over 30. And I'm like, well, how about 30? No, you're already over 32. We'll take that. Like, it was kind of like a thing like that. And I immediately, I laid awake that night. I remember so vividly. I laid awake that night thinking, I can't believe it. They took my first offer. Like, what is wrong with the house? They just said yes. They didn't even put me on hold. They didn't even ask for like a second. They didn't say, hang on. They just said, yes, we could take anything over this amount. But now that you offered that, I can't go to this. So, well, I rescind that offer. I come back in with a lower one. No, come on, Dawn. You offered this. You were happy with it. You need to take it. Step up. And now I rolled that conversation around in my head. I swear to you, for 6 months, it drove me out of my mind. I couldn't get past the fact that they just said yes. So then I thought, I'm going to start making lower offers. And two other times in my life, and they were several years apart, all of them. So at one point, I was in the business for quite a long while, maybe 10 years or so. And I made a low offer, and the bank said, well, actually, we can take that. And I said, what? Because it hadn't happened for so long. I said, what do you mean you can take that? She says, well, I'm authorized. I can take that amount. And I said, okay, what's wrong with the house? Like, what's wrong? Someone died in it. Somebody murdered in it. There's a Barry's body under the porch. Like, what's wrong with the property? Why are you just taking that offer? That's a really low offer. That's my lowest offer. You just said yes without even asking your boss. What's wrong with the house? I don't even think I want to buy the house now. And so you want to make sure your offer's low enough that they're definitely going to say no. And if they say yes, take it. But if you're anything like me at all, you'll beat yourself up over the fact of why did they take that offer? It was super low. What's wrong? What do they know? I don't know. And then it just ruins the whole deal. Personally, for me, mentally, it ruins the whole deal. It's like, I didn't get to haggle. I didn't get to negotiate. I didn't get to send a big box of papers. I mean, how could they say yes like that? It literally drives me out of my mind. So. So you just have to make sure you're offering as low as you can. So the first offer, again, it's all about the homeowners. So we're talking about their hardship, losing their job, just whatever has happened. That's what we want to talk about, because I want to start off pulling the emotional strings of the bank. And even though I know the person at the bank doesn't really care about my homeowner, they're still human. And when we see, you know, on Facebook, we see sad animal videos and sad stories. We're like, oh, and we reach out. And sometimes we lend people money through, you know, trying to raise some money for something. And, you know, all this stuff happens because we're human. And by human nature, we feel bad for people that are in a bad situation, especially if it's worse than ours. So by talking about and bringing in the human factor, I'm trying to at least get the bank person just a little bit to feel bad about my homeowners, feel a little bit bad about their situation. I mean, just a little. And then the second offer, I'm going to talk a lot about the neighborhood, what's going on, the things in the neighborhood. And because I know that the loss mitigation rep is in a different state. And I know that they did send an agent, some sort of real estate agent by, to look at the house. I know they did that. So I'm like, hey, listen, you sent that agent by to look at this house. But that agent, they're just hoping to get the listing agreement. They don't really care about you, Mr. Banker. They don't care whether you guys make money or not. They just want to get the listing agreement. And so by going by that listing agreement, you know, do you know these things in the neighborhood? Do you know about the vandalism and this and that? And you go through all the things in the second offer, and they're like, no, my gosh, I did not know that. The house is so bad. Why do you want it? And so you have to have your script for that. But that comes next week. So the first offer is about the homeowners, the loss to the homeowner, and whatever their hardship is. They lost a job. They got their hours cut. They got sick. Somebody died. Something happened. They're going through a divorce. Whatever it is, it's the hardship. But be prepared to send the other things. Be prepared for a listing agreement. Get your agent lined up right now so that you're knocking on doors this week. So if you get a homeowner that's ready to go, you've got an investor-friendly real estate agent. So by next week, I want everyone to have an investor-friendly real estate agent And I want everyone to have an investor-friendly title company. Everybody, you have 1 week to find those two people. Now, I'm not going to make you go through the giant list of all the team players that you will eventually need, because it is a fairly lengthy list. And I don't want to overwhelm you because you have so many weeks to go still. But right now, you're going to, this week coming up, because we're in our third week now, you're going to put out an additional 25 signs, and you're going to go door knock 15 people. So if you didn't door knock anybody last week, and I only asked for 10. So if you didn't door knock anybody last week, you got to door knock 25 this week. And I tell you what, if you don't do it each week as I'm asking you to do it, it's going to snowball on you. And in a couple weeks, you're going to have to door knock 200 people. And then you're going to say, I can't do it. It's too much. The business is overwhelming. And then you're going to quit. So don't be a quitter. Don't be a person that stops and starts all the time. Be the person that sticks with it and be the person whose life changes. Okay? I can't stand quitters. My saying on my Skype, if you ever read my saying, is that winners never quit and quitters never win. So you can't strike out the ball if you don't step up to the plate. Okay, so every week that you don't do what I'm asking you to do, you're just getting yourself more and more buried. And at some point, it's going to be too overwhelming. And you're going to be like, oh, I just can't do this. And you're going to quit. So don't do that. Just do what I ask you to do. Knocked on 10 doors last week. If you didn't do it, you got 25 now. Now, can you do 25 in a week? Oh, of course you can. I can do it. Bill and I can knock out about 40 doors in a half of a day. Quick, bam, bam, bam. Are you interested? Are you not? Are you in? Are you out? Are you interested? Boom, 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 boom. We're done. But we also know how to pick through the people. We also know how to tell if someone's truly interested or not. So we've learned all that, but we learned all that because we got out and did it. You have a homeowner that's like, yeah, you know, come back Tuesday. It's like, no, sorry, let me have your phone number. Not driving back over here. I got a million more people that need my help. Not driving back over here at all. Give me your phone number. I'll call you. We'll try to work something out. That's how you have to be, because you have to weed out the people that aren't interested in doing something right now because, A, your paycheck depends on it, and, B, there's a million other homeowners that need your help legit in your own town. So you have to spend the time on the people that really want you to spend the time on them. Okay, so don't be afraid to weed people out. In fact, I'm going to give you this today. It's in the program. Let me give you this today, so I want you to start practicing it. Now, if you haven't read the programs yet, you're going to think like, wow, Dwan, that sounds so rude. I can't imagine myself saying that. But trust me, you will. So when I have a homeowner that I feel is a little wishy-washy, I say, you know what, Mary, let's just take a break here for a second. Let me just ask you a question. On a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being the highest, where do you rate your motivation level to get yourself out of this situation? And she says, well, I don't know, Dwan, I'm like an 8. So if I'm happen to be with him face to face, I sit back in my chair, I put down my pen, and I start gathering up my papers and closing my book, putting things back in the folders, whatever I've got with me, closing my computer. And I'm like, oh, I didn't realize you were only an 8. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to waste your time. I only work with people that are 10s. And there's so many 10s out there, I don't have time to work with an 8. So listen, Mary, it's been really great talking to you. Keep the fed up package. Keep all this stuff here. When you become a 10, you call me back. I'll be right back over here and I'll help you. And I am telling you, if you get up to walk away, or you walk away from the door, or you walk away from the kitchen table, or you get ready to hang up a phone, they're going to say, well, no, hang on a minute. And they say, what's it take to be a 10? And I say, oh, well, a 10 is a person who's ready to get out of their situation, and they let me do my job, and they sign everything I need signed. They do everything I ask them to do. They don't question and nitpick me to death like you're doing, because they understand that this is my job, and this is what I do for a living, and I'm the one that knows what they're doing. Unfortunately, you're in foreclosure right now, so I don't really think taking advice from you is in my best interest. I think you taking advice from me is in your best interest. So tens do whatever I need. And eights, they don't. So when you're a 10, I'll come back. It's no big deal. There's no hard feelings. Good luck. I cannot tell you. 90% of people be like, no, hang on. I think I'm a 10. Just tell me what you need me to sign. What do you want me to do? And we'll get out of it. I got to move. I got to move on. I can't take it anymore. So the only reason people even hesitate is because you haven't taken control. So anytime I start to sense that a homeowner is wishy-washy or unsure or just anything, I'm like, oh, you know what? I must not have taken enough control because now I got a 1 to 10 them. So I don't do it very often, but when I do have to do it, if they're not a 10, they are when I get ready to end the conversation. I say, oh, well, okay, so now you're a 10. Okay, now are you sure you're a 10? Because a 10's like ready to roll. Don't make me waste a bunch of time. I've got so many people, and I'll show them sometimes my leads because we buy those late leads, so we always have 500 leads, and I always have them printed out and have them with me. I'm like, look, I have 500 leads right here of other people that need help. So if you're not serious, let me go because I got to go help somebody else. And they're like, no, I'm ready. Just whatever you need me to do, you just say, let's go. I'm good. So I'm really strict with people. I'm strict with you guys. I'm strict with homeowners too. Because I'm telling you, one of the biggest things I learned looking back on my career was in my first, I'm going to say probably 10 years. In my first 10 years, any homeowner that wanted to work with me, I would just like jump in the car and run to their house. And anyone that had any interest at all, I'd be over there in a minute because it never occurred to me people were going to be wasting my time and dragging me. I didn't know enough to know that. No one ever said, hey, stop letting homeowners waste your time. You are wasting ungodly amounts of time trying to work with people that aren't ready to work with you. No one ever told me that. So I didn't know the things that I didn't know. And that's why having a mentor is so important, because the things that you don't know, I already know them because I already did them. So I spent, there's so many nights. Like I ate out of bed and went to someone's house, and then I'd work with them for months and the deal would fall apart because they changed their mind and just all kinds of stuff. So I started getting firmer. I started realizing my time has more value. And when I started getting firmer and I started realizing I have more value and I started realizing I can't put up with all this BS anymore and people just need to do what I tell them to do. That's just the way it's got to be. And I started taking charge of everything. It was a miracle how all of a sudden I had probably 1/3 of the contracts and double the deals. So I worked less because I worked smarter instead of harder. So that is true. You can work much smarter. And by being on this Beat the Bank Bootcamp, you're going to be working smarter because you're not going to go to contract with homeowners that aren't ready. And you're going to learn enough about the bank's point of view to ask them a lot of super good questions to get your deals done so that your deals won't be really time consuming. You should not have more than 10 hours total invested from the moment you speak to the homeowner, to the bank, to the day that you go to the closing and get your check. You should not have more than 10 hours in that deal. If you have more than 10 hours in that deal, you need to fine-tune your scripts. You need to be stronger. You need to have bigger cojones. You need to be able to cut homeowners loose. Because you have to understand, this was one of the hardest things for me. In the very beginning, I became really attached to homeowners. Like as soon as I realized, after my very first deal, I saw this woman get a fresh start and I saw how happy she was. And I was out of my mind over the fact I had $22,000. It was like, oh my gosh, how is this possible, you know? And she was thrilled. And I thought, man, this is amazing. It was like, it's addictive, you know? And so after I realized like what a super great thing I was doing, I was all over. I'm like, I want to work with everybody. I want to save the world. And then when I wouldn't be able to help a homeowner or the bank would say no, or I just couldn't structure the deal, I would be so depressed. And I would go to bed at night like, oh, I failed these people. It's my fault. And I just finally started realizing that, you know what? It is not my fault. I didn't fail them. I can only help people the best that I can help them. And you are not the answer to everybody's problem. The fact that you're at the door means that you definitely are meant to play a role in their situation, but you are not the answer for each person. Some people still lose their house, and I believe that that's God working with them and showing them, like, hey, you're financially irresponsible. You've been evicted before. You've lost a house in foreclosure. It's their lesson to learn. You may be a part of it. And other deals, you'll close the whole entire deal because you were the answer for that homeowner. So sometimes you're just a piece of their puzzle, and sometimes you're their answer. And after, and I tell you, I had actually prayed about this a long time ago because the people I couldn't help were losing their houses, and I was feeling so bad and, like, you know, guilty that I could have done more. And then I just felt like God, like, literally put it on my heart one day. I was like, Tuan, listen, honey, you are not the answer for every single person. You can't save the world. I'm working with them. I'm teaching them the lesson. You are a piece of the lesson. You're a piece of the puzzle. The ones I want you to help, I'll bring them to you. And the ones where you're just a portion, you walk away with a good heart because you did everything that I let you do. So I was like, okay, Lord, thank you. I feel so much better now. But really, because I would be so upset when people would lose their house. And I went by a few people's houses when they were moving all their stuff and they're all crying. It was like, oh my gosh, this is awful. I was like, Lord, why can't I help them all? And, you know, I just became to realize it's like with you guys. There's so many people that buy programs and they really do. Honestly, you really do want to be successful, but you don't really have the gumption to do it. You're not really going to stick with it. And you know you're not, but you're doing to make yourself feel better. You're sticking with whatever program you have. And I'm not saying my students don't stick with it. It's just human nature. And all the people in all the world that sell training programs and stock market programs and whatever program is out there, people just don't stick with stuff. That's just the way people are. That's why the people sell, the gyms sell a million gym memberships. If every single person that owned a gym membership showed up at the same time, you couldn't get into the building. That's why diet companies, what are those commercials? Weight Watchers, Jenny Craig. All your food delivered to your door. You never have to cook again. Well, if that stuff worked and everybody did and everybody was successful, they wouldn't need those kind of things. You know, so people count on you to fail. That's why a lot of people do the big giant seminar circuit and they're in the seminar business because they count on you buying the programs and never attending the boot camps. If every person that bought the programs attended all the boot camps, they'd have to rent out like convention centers. And they don't. They rent little hotel rooms that seat about 75 people. Go to the next one and you count. 75 people in the seats. That's all they need to sell 50 of the people. And if the 50 that buy, 5 of them, 10, we'll come, maybe more will come to the next thing because that's where the upside to the big program. And then from that, they count on you not doing anything. If everybody did it, they wouldn't be able to stay in business. So they count on you dropping off. I, on the other hand, I don't expect you or count on you to drop off. I count on you to do what I'm asking you. I count on you to Skype me. I count on you to be accountable. And I count on you to be successful because when you're successful, I'm successful. Okay. So just realize as you start into this career that you cannot save everybody. You are a piece of the puzzle for some, and for some, you're the answer. And the ones you're not the answer to, those are the ones you got to buckle down on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being high. Where do you rate your motivation level to get out of your situation? And if they're anything but a 10, if they're 9.5, anything but a 10, you are done with them. Unless they say the words out loud, what does it take to become a 10? Okay, I've changed my mind. I'm a 10. Anything other than that, you say, when you become a 10, here's my card. You contact me and I'll help you. Now, I've said this a million times. So I'm going to say it a million and one. One of the biggest reasons that investors fail is they don't follow up. So if someone tells you they're an 8 or a 9 or a 7, you get their card, get their information, write it down, whatever you got to do, put it in your computer. You call them back in 30 days and see where they are. Because I guarantee you the next letter they get from the bank or the next, hey, this is the day your house is going to sale, the next anything, they're going to become a 10. Okay, so you have to follow up. If you don't follow up, then all you're doing is constantly looking for new people. So you have to follow up, otherwise you're always looking for new people. So don't be the guy that's always looking for new people, because you're going to never make it in this business if you're always looking for new people. Follow up. Half of the people that you follow up with will do something. The other half will drop off. But the good thing about the ones that drop off is you didn't waste your time with them. And the good things about the ones that do work with you, they're ready. They're tens now. Okay? All right. So now listen, this week we're in week 3. So I need 15 door knocks and I need 25 signs. So that's going to give you a total. I'm just going to give you a total of 50 signs because I'm going to assume the first week nobody got their signs out. But last week, I'm going to assume you did 25 signs. So last week and this week, you did 25 signs. So you've got 50 signs out and you have talked to 25 people. Now, with 25 people and 50 signs, you should now already be having people talking to that are willing to go to contract. So read through your programs, listen back over the last 3 weeks. Next week, I want you to have your real estate agent lined up. You've talked to a bunch of them. You've gone through some. You don't go have lunch and spend, don't waste a bunch of time. Talk to people on the phone. Make sure they're what you want. Work with those people. Get rid of the rest. You guys waste too much time. Like, you don't need to take someone out to lunch to see if they're the right person. Ask them on the phone. Are you a real estate agent? Yes. Do you work with investors? Yes. Do you know how to present a short sale to the bank if the bank asks you to do it? Yes. They say no, but will you let me teach you? Yes, I will. Okay, great. Let's try a deal together. That's it. Just need a couple questions and you're done. Give them a chance. You don't need to go have lunch and interview 15 people. If you go to lunch and if you go out and interview 15 people this week and eat out with all of them, you're going to get fat. So don't do that. You don't need all that eating out and all those calories and all that crap and all that time sitting around. Get it done. Find a few people. Move on. Get knocking on doors, talking to people, and get going. Call some title companies. Find one that's investor friendly. And then when you find one that's investor friendly, start asking them what their fees are. What are your fees to close deals? Have them print you out what's called a HUD statement. It's a HUD, it's a settlement statement, whatever they're calling it, whatever you want to call it. It's a closing statement. Like if you close an actual deal, how much money would the title company charge for their fees? They have to prepare documents. They have to do the closing. They have to do a title search. They have to do all these different things. So what are they going to charge? So ask them, would you just print me out a list? Would you print me out a sample HUD on a $200,000 deal? And send it over to me, a $200,000 house. Would you send it, fax it, or email it, or whatever? Send it over to me so I have it so I can just look at some of your fees and ask a couple different title companies. What are your fees? Could I just get a sample closing statement, a sample HUD 1, sample settlement statement? Could I just get a sample of what it looks like if you close a deal with me on, say, a $200,000 house? And just look and compare. Because some title companies, they charge insane amounts of money for document prep. And then they charge to prepare the documents for you to buy it. They charge it for you to close it. They charge. And you can negotiate with title companies to knock off some of those fees. And the bigger you become in your area and the bigger you become in your arena, and when you become the top dog or one of the top dogs, you can tell the title companies, no, that's not going to happen. Knock off half these fees. I'm going to move my business someplace else. They've already agreed to knock off a bunch of fees. You're double dipping. You don't need to charge me so much money. I'm not going to pay for all that. Give me your best deal. But you can't do that right now because you haven't closed any deals yet. So you don't have a leg to stand on yet. But when you start closing deals, that's when everything, that's how come people that make money make more money. Because you get title companies to come down on their fees. And you get banks to come down on their fees. You fine tune things. You get the bank to pay the people. You get the bank to pay you. Your check is a net check in your pocket. And you start making more because you're smarter. All right, so get smart with me. All right, 25 signs, 15 additional doors. Find your title company, find your agent, and if anyone's ready to go to deal, read through the program, and it tells you items that could be on the checklist for the first side, for the first offer, but just ask the bank specifically. What exactly do you need from me so I can get a yes from you? Tell me everything you need in one shot. I'll get all of it. I'll have it for you in 72 hours, whatever it is. Get everything. Get it all together. Don't send them in partial pieces. Get the whole package. Get the whole thing together. Send them the entire thing when you have it ready. Okay? So doing that, you're just going to move on and get better and better and better. And it's going to be great. So, all right, guys. Absorb all this. And I'll be back next Monday. We'll be doing week 4. We'll be talking about the second offer. Thanks for being part of the Beat the Bank Boot Camp. If you have not opted into my site, Investors Edge University, go opt in over there. I have some free stuff for you. You get a free book with Steve Forbes that I wrote. You get a free book with Dan Kennedy that Bill wrote. So get some stuff. You know, everybody likes free stuff. I love free stuff. So everybody loves free stuff. So go get some free stuff. And we'll be back next week, same bad time, same bad channel. So everybody have a Dwan-tastic week.